her wound is as incurable. It came as far as Judah, and it has reached even to the gates of my people, even as far as the city of twofold peace, Jerusalem. Micah chapter 1 verse 9, her wound is as incurable. From the Ward Green Translation 2003, our daily scripture for today, little children. And as we saw, children, of course, can refer to children of the light, not necessarily referring to how old someone is. And now, as we return to the study of our article, the Archipelago, the Orient Express, we are now at the point where there are only three paragraphs remaining in the article, and then there's some notes perhaps after that. So shall we read? Using the scientific method, we start with a postulate or hypothesis and create procedures which test its validity. Thus, there is an inherent and necessary bias in using the scientific method, and the procedure only works to prove a postulate when some postulate was true from the beginning, or at least when that postulate produces some useful result. Doesn't mean it's necessarily true, because there could be a better postulate, but let's not digress too far. Were we to choose postulates randomly, there would be zero probability of proving them correct. And despite a life of hard work, all of our efforts would prove to be fruitless. A car engine, which has not been tuned, does not tune itself randomly, and it doesn't run well until it has been tuned. But we can't know how well it runs unless we start it up. Then, we don't know it runs well without driving the car. The best test is the sound and feel of the engine pulling. But none of this really matters if the car wasn't designed well, because it can only perform as well as it was built. Now, if you don't drive, or you don't tune the engine, you are not going to find out how well the engine can perform. The same thing is true with regards to the Bible teaching. It cannot be tested unless it is first postulated as true. Without using it, its performance cannot anyhow be gauged. Postulating that the Bible is true may be a great first step, but the scientific method is not the only thing to follow. Much of the history that gets presented, as though not from the Bible, is actually based on that very book, and it gets taught in the Western world from an early age, as we know. I went to Sunday school until I no longer believed that I was learning anything, or because I preferred my own ideas. Remember your grand creator in the days of your youth, the scripture says, before the calamitous days have come, when you shall then say, quote, I have no delight in them, end quote. The greatest maxim in all of scripture is the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The double-edged sword of preaching is that we are subject to the same rule expressed by our word. It cuts both ways. The pure language may be the word of truth. It may be that tongue that was spoken in 2710 BCE before the dispersion at Pentecost of 29 CE. Tongues of fires appeared above the person of each Christian disciple as the Holy Spirit came down from heaven upon them. And they started to speak, each one with a different tongue, as the Spirit granted to them. I encourage others to tell their family stories to us all. And that's the end of paragraph 10. In chapter 12 of the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express, which is our study for today, I just want to make a couple of notes there that are rather interesting. You notice we even mentioned the 2710 here date, which is very close to 2711, which is a date that I more or less discovered during the time we've been reading this article. I discovered the importance of 2711 in ways that I'd never seen before. So 2710 is close enough to that 2711 that it rings true. And as far as 29 CE goes, which is after the turn of the Common Era, Pentecost of 29, well, it was actually Pentecost of 30 CE when Jesus had already been resurrected and when the tongues of fire appeared. But you could interpret this according to a different calendar system. That is the Jewish secular calendar that began in the fall of the year, every year, the autumn of the year. And that, according to that calendar, if the year in the Jewish calendar that began in 29 CE, in the fall or autumn of that year, about 6 months later, there would be Pentecost of the year 30 CE, which would be in the Jewish year that had begun in 29 CE. So it still is possible to see it as being true, depending on the calendar you're using. But at the time I wrote this article, I don't know whether I had identified the date of the crucifixion, because that was not done until the article Born and Raised, which came only quite recently and much later than this. When was the article Born and Raised written? Let's see. I have it right here. Let's see. Let's see when it was written. It was first published as article number 18 in the series of these genealogical articles, and it was February 28th, 2021, first publication of the article Born and Raised. So it was in 2021, which is about 10 years after this article was written. I don't know how I had arrived at 29 CE in this article, but that's the way it was. I don't know if I need to edit it or add a footnote or something, maybe, but anyway, that's all for that for today. I want to show you something totally different now. I'm going to try to explain how we know that the universe is expanding, okay? And this is not something that I understood until I watched this video that I'm going to show you. It's from the website of a person I believe to be an excellent teacher of this, physics, the science of which is, or the study, the details of which are in large part, of course, at least much of what he says is due to the theory of relativity. Even I believe talking about the Doppler shift of the light waves that we're going to encounter in this video. When something is moving, and the tricky part about this is that even though something is moving, as far as we see, we might see it as moving. But to the person that we see moving, from their point of view, they're not moving. They're just, as long as they're not, you know, accelerating and going faster and faster. If they're moving at a constant speed and we're here and we see them moving, there's no way of telling which of us is moving. So to them, they're at rest, and to us, we're at rest. So to them, light moves away from them at the speed of light, right? Whereas to us, since they're moving, that's no longer true, because we see their light moving at the speed of light. the light that's emitted by them, that is, by some light source that it is traveling with them, but we also see them moving relative to the light. And so they could be catching up to the light, or at least reducing, they can't actually catch up to it, but they can reduce the speed of the light from our viewpoint. But the light still travels in our frame of reference from our viewpoint at the speed of light. It's just that they're also moving at the speed of light, at the speed, some speed less than the speed of light. They're also moving. So if they're moving toward, in the direction of that light, as the light moves away from them, then that's going to, from our viewpoint, slow down the speed that the light is moving, and therefore the light will be bunched up. The light waves, there are waves, let's say, think of it as water waves. The waves are going to be closer together if they're moving so as to try and seemingly try and catch up to it. If they're moving in the same direction as that light wave, then they're going to be catching up, you know, or causing a compression of those waves from our viewpoint. That's a Doppler shift. They're not going to see the Doppler shift because they think from their viewpoint they're not moving at all. They're just at rest. And from their viewpoint, the light has to be moving at the speed of light. Whereas from our viewpoint, this is Einstein's theory that the light, the speed of light is always the same for all observers. So since the speed of light is the same for us observing them, we have a different sense of how fast the light is moving relative to them. Right? Whereas relative to us, the speed of light is always going to be the same constant value that it always is. Right? In our frame, according to us, and in their frame, according to them, same thing. Speed of light is always the same constant speed. They're not going to see the bunching up. But this is the Doppler shift that we're going to see about here. But first of all, how did the story start?
So if you're ready to rediscover the real story of how we figured out the universe is expanding, let's begin. So let's back up a little bit, because it all starts when we ask a fundamental question to the man who started it all, Newton. So, Newton, according to you, everything attracts everything else in the universe. If that is the case, and if the universe has been there forever, that was the dominant view back then, that the universe was eternal, then the question was, why hasn't everything just clumped together?
And yeah, if the universe has been there forever and gravity's the only force, then everything would gravitate and pull inward, and everything would be in one big clump, wouldn't it, if the universe had been there forever?
Newton's answer to this is, I don't know, he really had no answer for this question.
Yeah, Newton couldn't answer that problem of, well, you know, because it was common, or it was, what's the word, popular to believe that the universe had been here forever. Just simpler. It was a simpler thought, but then it couldn't explain why hadn't all the mass been bunched up due to gravity.
So we move on, and we talk to Einstein, who has a much better theory of gravity.
Okay.
Einstein, yeah. Same question. And Einstein says, I do have an answer for you. What if, at large distances...
Einstein didn't believe in Newton's theory of gravity anyway. He had this the general theory of relativity, which is a whole different explanation of how mass bends space and all of that, and time. So he didn't use Newton's ideas to explain gravity in the first place, but he had an equation for explaining all of this.
Gravity is also having some kind of a repulsive force that could counter.
Yeah, Einstein added the idea that there was a repulsive force when masses were far apart. So they didn't just attract and pull each other in due to gravity, but they also pushed apart if they were far apart. This was just his idea. It wasn't the truth. It didn't prove to be true, but it was his idea. It was his biggest blunder, people have said.
Attractive forces, and the universe could stay balanced.
That way the universe wouldn't draw in into one clump, because at great distances there was, according to his theory, a repulsive force that kept them apart. So as long as they were a certain distance apart, they would stay apart, and they wouldn't come closer than a certain distance. You know, so the universe could have been there forever and not collapsed on itself.
In fact, you can even see this in his field equations. See, the original field equation had the space-time curvature.
There's the equation that shows the space-time curvature
on the left side,
which causes gravity. That's with the big G is the gravitational constant that determines how big that force is, right? Anyway, let's not worry about what that all means, because the main point is the next term.
Constant and matter and energy on the right side. So matter and energy tells space-time how to curve. That produces the attractive gravity.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. We can talk about that hopefully another time. But
then he added in another term. The negative sign represents that it has the opposite effect on the space-time curvature of matter and energy, so this produces the anti-gravity repulsive force. And it does not depend on matter and energy, it is purely a function of space, and he tweaked this constant just to get the universe balanced. And he called it the infamous cosmological constant. So look, the universe was balanced. And at this point, I'm like, Einstein, do you just pull out this term out of thin air just to make the universe stable? And Einstein's like, yeah, but do you have anything better? Yes, I do, said Alexander Friedman, a Russian physicist. Friedman says he solved the Einstein's field equation for the entire universe by making some assumptions and realized you don't really need the repulsive term.
Yeah, so what Friedman said was that space can be expanding. That's what he said, which is different.
In fact, he figured out, according to Einstein's equations, the universe itself can be dynamic. It can be contracting or it can be expanding. So look, he says, Einstein, the universe doesn't even have to be static, so we don't need this term at all. And Einstein's response to this was, wow, that makes no sense. And this is probably how
Einstein couldn't agree with it, but the idea is, it's not the idea that just that these things are moving apart from each other, but that the whole space-time continuum is expanding. Space itself is expanding, not just the matter moving away from each other. Not just the pieces of matter and stars and all these planets moving apart from each other, moving away from each other, but the idea is that space itself is expanding. And I never really understood what was meant by that before. I mean, I couldn't really understand why that was necessary or really didn't get the sense that of what they were saying. I didn't understand, but this explains all of it in this video.
Friedman, give me your notes. Let me check. Hey, there's a mathematical error. And Friedman says, no, there isn't. And Einstein's like, yeah, no, there isn't. But still, it doesn't make sense. What are you talking about? Space stretching and expanding? That doesn't make sense.
He's talking about the distances and everything. Space itself is expanding. The actual space itself is expanding. So let's go to the next part of the video here. Okay.
For you and I, this is the perfect moment. This is the climax because this is where the groundbreaking discovery happens. Are you ready? Okay. While analyzing data, she found about 25 C5 variables all in one spot.
Henrietta Leavitt is the one who did this. A woman who was called a human computer. They used humans to do the computing back in those days at Harvard. And she discovered this group of stars called Cepheid stars, C-E-P-H-E-I-D, Cepheid, and they oscillate, okay?
A megalithic cloud.
And
what's interesting is that she found that they are not due to the distance.
We don't have time, so
this variation is truly because some Cepheids are bright.
They don't twinkle because of atmosphere. They're twinkling because they're oscillating. And then when she graphed them, she got this graph. They fell on a straight line so that their oscillation time period on the horizontal was in a straight line relationship to their brightness, their apparent brightness. They all fell approximately on that line. Okay, so the thing is, they were all in the Magellanic clouds, all of these stars were in the same sort of grouping of stars called the Magellanic Cloud, which existed approximately at the same distance from Earth. Too far away to measure the distance by normal parallax, by using a telescope on each side of the Earth. You know, you can use parallax, and just like you can do parallax with your two fingers by opening and closing one eye, you can determine, you know, something about how far your fingers move when you open the and close the other eye, you know, and so on. It's the same way that they can determine. He shows that in the video. Here it is right here. Yeah. So if you're looking from each side of the Earth at the star, you can project. You can't tell how far away it is from either side, but if you take the intersection of the two points, you get the actual star location using what's called parallax. So there you can see, without determining the distance, the star could be much further away, as shown in the illustration, in each case. But because the two lines intersect, the star is pinpointed as for distance. So then what happens is they found... Okay, yeah. All they had to do then was find... I think he's going to talk about that somewhere. Where is that? Is it here? Yes, maybe.
Can use the Leavitt's relationship, the period luminosity relationship, to find the true brightness of any other Cepheid. Long story short, because of Leavitt's law, as we call it today, we understood what was the true brightness of any Cepheid. You give me the period, and you will now figure out the true brightness of that Cepheid. It's true. Then...
So what happened? What happened?
Luminosity relationship to find the true brightness of any other Cepheid. Long story short, because of Leavitt's law, as we call it today, we understood what was the true brightness of any Cepheid. You give me the period, and you will now figure out the true brightness of that Cepheid. And we can use that as a standard for measuring distances. Isn't that incredible? So the big question is, how much of an upgrade was this? Well, remember, back then, the range of the parallax measurements was up to a few hundred light years. With Cepheid variables, that range increased to about a million light years. That's right. This gave us a serious upgrade on our distance measuring systems. And now...
So all you had to do was find another Cepheid for which you knew something for sure, either its true brightness or you knew its distance, and then you could place it on this graph and you could then calibrate. Well, if you knew anything specific like that, you could then calibrate for all Cepheids. Then you could find out how far away they were based on how fast they were oscillating. That was the idea, okay? But I think we missed part of that, the explanation as to how they did it. But we're going to have to go and just skip ahead here and see if we can find out. Okay. Hopefully.
First of all, her boss, named Harlow Shapley, who was the director of the Harvard Observatory, obviously got access to her publication, Leavitt's Law. And he immediately started identifying Cepheid variables within the Milky Way, and he found that the Milky Way was actually much bigger than previously expected, roughly about 100,000 light years. But more importantly, he also found some Cepheid variables in the center of the Milky Way, and by calculating how far that...
I'm just not remembering. How did they make the leap?
We had everything needed for discovering paradigm shifts in astronomy. So, let's calm down. What happens next? Exactly how bright it is, right? And Leavitt says, no, Mahesh, almost, because this is the apparent brightness. This is not the true brightness. But that's okay. Now, all we have to do is find a Cepheid variable within our parallax.
That's right. They found a Cepheid variable that was in 100 light years of our planet, and that they could use parallax to find the true distance. That's what they did. Okay, so then they had this curve was calibrated, and they could determine how far away those stars were. And they were in the Magellanic Cloud system, and they then knew how far away those clouds were. But they also knew any other Cepheid star. They could tell exactly how far away it was now because they'd found one within the range of our parallax method, using the intersection method, right? That's what it was. Okay, I'd forgotten what the details were. I almost got lost there. So then this gentleman, Harlow Shapley, he was able to determine that we were not at the center of the Milky Way galaxy using this same method of finding a Cepheid star. He determined it was 100,000 light years that we were away. We were that far away from the center. Okay, so now what?
This now brings us to the most important discovery Hubble ever made. Remember how Slipher had already calculated the...
Now we're at Edwin Hubble and the discovery he made. Okay.
Redshift values, and he had figured out how fast these things were already moving. But we didn't know what that meant. Now Hubble said, hey, let me just go ahead and...
I think we're missing something. Let's keep going here.
That was, he realized that it was about 30,000 turned astronomer. He found a cified variable in the Andromeda, which means he could now find the distance to it. And what did he find? Well, he found for the very first time the distance to the Andromeda to be close to 1,000,000 light years. This means for the very first time we realize that the Andromeda is not within the Milky Way, but it's much outside. And by looking at its apparent size, we now figured out that it must be much bigger, like a galaxy. This is how humanity discovered a new galaxy.
That was the first time that anyone ever knew that there was more than one galaxy, okay?
This was huge. Remember, this is as huge as today discovering new universe altogether. Now, of course,
and that happened after the development of Einstein's theory of relativity. That came first. At that time, everyone still believed there was only one galaxy. Apparently, there was no one else who could prove anything different.
Of course, we know that this
until this
was an underestimate. The
that's Edwin Hubble. Okay,
actual value is close to about 2.5 million light years. Okay. Meaning things were already moving. But we didn't know...
Let's go to the next one.
Find some C5 variables. Then I can figure out how far these things are. And he did that. In a few years, he figured out that all of these galaxies are millions of light years away.
Hubble discovered this.
Most importantly, right. He found a beautiful relationship between the distance and the recession velocity.
He found
that the galaxies that are closer are moving a bit quicker how far these things are. And he did that. Let me just go moving. But we didn't know, which now brings us to the most important discovery Hubble ever made.
That's Hubble, remember? Yeah. So Hubble discovered that all these galaxies were moving away from each other, right? With this Doppler shift.
He figured out that all of these galaxies are millions of light years away. But most importantly, he found a beautiful relationship between a diversity.
What I need to
find. He found that they all lie pretty much on a straight line.
And the further away they were, the faster they were moving away from us. This straight line graph, another straight line graph. Okay.
This is called the Hubble's law. But what?
Now what? Now what is the question? Let's go to the next one.
Ones that are closer move away at a shorter, at a shorter velocity, and the ones that are farther, they move away a lot more.
So the way that you can tell they're moving away is because they're redshifted. Redshifted means they're Doppler shifted. By moving away from us, so their wavelengths are getting stretched as they move away, as I was explaining earlier. Whereas if they'd been moving toward us, their wavelengths would have been getting bunched up as they came toward us, getting closer together and closer together and closer together and closer together, because they would be moving to keep up with the light. And that would shorten their wavelength and make them bluer, because blue is a shorter wavelength than red. So if they're moving away from us, they're redshifted. It's called a Doppler shift in the red. Redshifted. These galaxies, most of them are moving away from us, and therefore they are Doppler shifted to the red. And this was discovered by, who was it? Schleifer, I think, but somebody else. Anyway, let's see who it is here. Let's see who, find out where he's here, too. Got a lot of things here. No, that's not it. Here it is, here. Vesto Schleifer, is he the one? Yeah. He made the first measurements of the radial velocities for galaxies. In other words, they're moving away from us, along as though we're at the center of a circle. So it's like a radius of a circle. But it's since we're not special, it must be true of every point in space that, at least logically, we shouldn't assume we're special. So everywhere it must be the same, and the only way to explain that is if the space itself is expanding. Hopefully we're going to see that in a minute here.
Exactly aligning with Hubble's law. And notice there's nothing special about Milky Way. If I change the vantage point, let's say I look at the same thing, this expansion from this perspective, I get the same result. Now, boom, you see that everything is moving away from this one according to the Hubble's law. That is beautiful, isn't it?
If the space itself is expanding, then every point is moving away from every other point. You see? Every point in space moves away from every other point in space. So that explains why the galaxies are redshifted. The light coming from them is redshifted. Now, we didn't get to that drawing of the redshift. I want to show that somewhere. Where is it? See if we can find it here. Is that earlier on in his talk? I think it was earlier on. Here it is. Yeah, right here. Let's see it. Yeah.
There's a time today where we believe there's only one huge spiral-looking things where they...
Where is it? Here it is.
Towards the red end of the spectrum, we call that the redshift. If something is redshifted...
See, if it's moving along to catch up with the light, then it makes the wavelength shorter from our viewpoint, and that makes it blue. But it's a consequence only of Einstein's theory, because, you see, if we didn't have Einstein's theory, we wouldn't be able to say or explain why, you know, why could they... I mean, we wouldn't know that the speed of light... We wouldn't have any way of knowing how to judge how fast the light was moving relative to us or relative to them unless we had Einstein's postulate that the speed of light was the same for all observers. So from their viewpoint, you know, the speed of light is actually not... Looking at it from our viewpoint, it looks like to us that the light's not moving away from them as fast on the one side as it is on the other, right? Because there's a longer wavelength to the left, and on the right there's a blue shift on where the waves are getting bunched up. Let's see if we can play that.
You know, it's going away from us, and it gets stretched out, giving you longer wavelengths. And shorter wavelengths look to us...
Because the light source is moving, as the light's moving, and... It's re-emitting a new pulse each time, right? But it's already sort of partially caught up with the previous wave before it emits the second pulse. But that's all from our viewpoint. It's not going to see that from its viewpoint. The person on board that ship or in that world that's moving at that speed, they're not going to see that. They're going to see light just moving away from them in concentric circles, just like we would see if we had a light source here. And we're at rest, they would see themselves at rest, and there would be no bunching up from their viewpoint. It's only from our viewpoint that it occurs, because the speed of light must be the same for all observers, you know, and that's true. But it causes this all kinds of other changes, like time dilation and the Lorentz space contraction occurs due to relativity, which is another thing entirely that we're not getting into today. But we've talked about it before. It causes, and it also causes the difference in the relative simultaneity of events, too. But we'll talk about that hopefully another time. But January 21st, 2025, of the Common Era, I can't believe I got through that. It's 21:42 hours Canadian Eastern Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. And thank you so much for listening and watching. In my behalf, this is Sissy, and this is Star saying bye for now. That was Chapter 12, Paragraph 10 of the Ark of Urartu.